Folks, get settled in, please. Okay. Okay, I'm going to pass out the exams. Same rules as last time. If you don't remember, keep the quiz face down till everybody has a copy. Write your name on the back. Don't sign it, don't autograph, nothing. I just write your name on the back so that I can read it. So everybody find a seat. Try to have at least one seat between you and the next person that you're sitting. Okay. Take a quiz first. Excuse me. Don't worry, just hold on to it. Is somebody sitting where? There's not enough room there, so they'll have to sit somewhere else. Folks, quiz is officially on, so please. Roy, restrain yourself. Start you for this entire section. Don't turn over yet. This whole section. Okay. Everybody have you? No? So is that why you were breaking up? Everybody have a quiz here? I'll get to you. Okay, you can turn your quiz over, write your name on the front.
10 minutes left.
minute left. Okay, time is up. Please hand your quizzes in towards the end of each row. Time is up. Time is up. Please hand your quizzes in towards the end of each row. Thank you. Hand your quizzes in towards the end of each row, please. Somebody, they might go the other way. Don't do that. Any more quizzes down here? Thank you. Okay, no comparisons of quizzes. Time is up. Thank you. Any more quizzes out there? Okay. Missed them. Go, run after them.
Oh, where are they?
They're already leaving. Okay. Get settled in, please. Okay, folks. So let's do a very quick review of the quiz while it's still fresh. Well, I'll have to take points off because you missed the hand again, so. Okay, folks, get settled in. Let's start with problem one. At least a half a dozen of you. Hey, guys, settle in. Okay? At least a half a dozen of you during the quiz asked me what currency I want the cost of capital in. All my numbers, what currency could I give you the cost of capital? But did I give you two risk-free? No, no, wait. What did I give you? I gave you two government bond rates, but I didn't give you two risk-free rates. I gave you U.S. dollar T-bond rate. And for Brazil, what did I give you? A dollar-denominated bond rate. If I'd given you nominal real, then, of course, you could have done a nominal real. But I didn't give you, I gave you only one risk-free rate, one currency. The Brazilian government bond rate I gave you was a U.S. dollar rate. If I'd given you a nominal real rate, then you could use that as a proxy for inflation. Yeah. There was no way to do it, right? So if you gave me a nominal real rate, you are either a Nobel Prize winner, potentially, or you find an incredibly creative way to come up with a number you couldn't come up with, right? You're saying, but it's a Brazilian project. What currency was the Brazilian, the Rio Disney in? It was a Brazilian project, but I did everything in U.S. dollars. Currency is a choice, folks. You do not have to do everything in the local currency. Hey? So I gave you everything in U.S. dollars. In fact, if I'd wanted you to give me a nominal real cost of capital, what did I need to give you? Roy? I'd have to give you inflation in both countries. If I'd given you that, then there's one extra step. You can take that extra inflation. Second problem. And relative to the Netflix case, this was three line items, right? Additional revenues, additional EBITDA. The only thing was if you remember to subtract depreciation out before you did taxes and add that back. And if you're still having trouble with that, you deserve to lose points. Okay? Because that's really the only thing in 2A. Did you take out the depreciation and add it back? I had no working capital, no G&A, no twists and turns there. 2B. The only thing was you go from the cash flow to the net present value. I gave you the discount rate. Again, no confusion. I gave you one discount rate. All you needed to do was remember to bring in the initial investment and bring in the salvage value. No working capital, nothing tricky there. 2C, we actually went through in the review session, right? What's the value of depreciation? It's just the tax rate times the dollar depreciation. That you get every year. The present value of that annuity is the present value of what it adds to your net present value. Now, in problem three, what were you given? You were given the net present value the analyst came up with, and I gave you two line items. The first was, I said, he subtracted out all of G&A, when in fact he should have used only the 20% that's incremental. So you've got to reverse that, right? So what effect will that have on your net present value? Increase it or decrease it? It's going to increase it by how much? How would I compute it? Basically, take 80% of the G&A, remember to take the tax effect out. Take the present value and you're done. What is the second item you forgot? Working capital. And what did I say about working capital? There's an investment up front and then you get it all back at the end. You're saying then there's no effect. There is still an effect, right? If I have minus 40,000 up front or whatever you got in your particular problem and I get plus 40,000 in 5 years, the effect on your net present values is the difference between the two numbers. Net present values, you can always isolate what changes and figure out the effect on the net present value. So the usual rules apply. As soon as the quizzes are done, you'll get that email saying, come and get them. Yeah, yeah, it's just. They're all dollar numbers, right? Yeah, so they're actually consistent. That's what we always do, right? Yeah. So the one more thing on problem one, I gave you two betas, right? Come on, this was Netflix one extension. What do we keep saying about the Netflix case? When you look at a project, you have to use the beta of the business the project is in, not the beta of the company. So I promised you that everything in this quiz would build off something on the Netflix case, and it did, right? There were pieces of it that you saw. Right? One more thing, I do know that some of you have, a few of you have, not that many, three or four groups have had issues with the case. Don't take it to the TAs. If you have an issue with the case, come to me. Okay, I'm the only one who can fix it because I'm the one who graded it. So if you have a problem with your case grading, you think I've missed something that you did, bring it in and I'll take a look at it. I can't promise you're going to get the half a point or the point or whatever you're fighting for. but I'll give you a fair hearing if that's what you think you need. Okay? Any other questions? Yes, Roy.
This may be a more profound question, but fixed
GNA. Yep. Okay, let's go through it. So what happened? What did the analyst do? He subtracted out all of GNA, right? Now, what do we say? 80% of that GNA is going to be fixed, and it's going to be there anyway. So you shouldn't have subtracted out. So we're going to take it out of the analysis. What does that mean? So it'll always, exactly. So that's the way to think about it, is always isolate the effect. Say, what has it done to my cash flows? How do I get it out of my cash flows? And that'll kind of always lead you to the answer. Right? Any other questions? Okay, so let's pick up where we left off. We were talking about the first large advantage of debt, which is a tax advantage. One thing I'd suggest you do, what is that? Somebody's actual quiz they've left on the ground. That's quite sloppy. Maybe they hope they won't find it. No. Yeah. Okay. Did it get, were there more quizzes I should be getting? Okay, good. Okay, you can keep that one. Okay. So you do know we're in a presidential campaign, right? One thing I'd suggest you do is look at the tax plans that all of the candidates have out there relating to corporate taxes. Because we talked about the tax benefit of debt. Take a look at these tax plans, and here's what I'd like you to think about. I'm not asking who you were going to vote for. I don't care. I want you to isolate the corporate tax effect and how you think it will play out in this trade-off between debt and equity. So first big advantage of debt is a tax advantage. Let's move to the second one. At least in some companies, you could argue that maybe making managers borrow more money can make them more disciplined in their project choice. Let me explain. Remember when we talked about corporate governance, we talked about how managers make decisions that are often in their best interest, not in the stockholders' best interest? Let's say your managers at a large publicly traded company, a mature company with lots of cash flows coming in from existing projects, billions. And you find a project that's a bad project, but it'll make you feel as a manager much better. What's the definition of a bad project? It earns a return less than your required rate of return. Makes a 3% return. But here's how you reason through it. If I take this bad project, who's going to notice? I have this big mature company, lots of earnings and cash flows. If I take a bad project, people are not going to notice. I'll be sloppy. So managers at large publicly traded companies, especially mature companies, will tend to get sloppy in their project choice because it's other people's money. So how is that debt going to fix that? Let's say I make this company go out and borrow money. When they borrow money, they have interest expenses to meet, right? So if you now go out and take the same bad project you did yesterday, see the consequence you could face? That project could actually mean you can't make your interest payments. If you don't make your interest payments, what happens to the company? It goes bankrupt. It goes bankrupt. What happens to your job? You lose it. I'm trying to make this personal. I'm saying you don't care about my money. I'm going to make you care about your job, and maybe it'll make you a little more disciplined. It sounds like an extreme way to get people's attention, right? I call this the Volvo argument for debt. Let me explain why I call this the Volvo argument for debt. Let's assume it's a year out or 2 years out or whenever you graduate. You go to work for Goldman Sachs. You rise up the ranks really fast. You're now a managing director. You move out to the suburbs. You buy this big house. You have two dogs, two cars, two spouses, whatever makes you happy. I don't care. Yeah. And every day you take the train into work. Live only 5 minutes away from the station, but you're too lazy and fat to walk. So here are your two cars. Your first car is a Volvo 960 extra armored. You know what I'm talking about, which has front airbags back? It's like driving a tank around town. Somebody took a quiz and felt really good about it. The second car you have is some kind of a tin trap. I don't want to insult any of your cars, so I'll give it a name that probably none of you have. It's a Yugo. It's a car that when you get in, it starts to shake. When you drive on the highway, things start to fly off the car. Right? So your first day, it's your lucky day. You drive your Volvo into the train station. You park the car, 6 a.m. in the morning. You get on the train. You go into work. You work all day. You work all evening. You work all night. That's how you afford the big house, the two dogs, the two cars, the two spouses. 10 o'clock at night, you get off the train. You're exhausted. You can't even walk anymore. You crawl to your car. You get into your car. You get ready to drive home. You just want to get home. But there's this one traffic light between the train station and your house, which, if it turns red, takes forever to turn green. So you pull up to the top of the hill, and just as you get there, the light turns red. You say, oh, drat. Those would not be the words you use, but I'm censoring as I'm going along. And as you sit there watching the red light, illegal thoughts start to cross your mind. So what if I ran that red light? What are the two things you worry about for running red lights? One is you could get a ticket, but these are the suburbs. The police all go home at 7. The other is you could get hit, right? But you remember, you're in your Volvo extra armored. If somebody hits you, you get a little dent on the side. The other guy's all crumpled up, but that's his problem, not yours. You run through the red light. You get home safe. Next day, you repeat the process, but today you're in your Yugo. You chug, chug, chug to the station. You park the car. You get on the train. You go into work. You work all day. You work all 10 o'clock at night. You crawl into your Yugo. You get to the top of the hill, and the light turns red again. It's like a conspiracy. You get ready to hit the gas pedal to go through. That's what you did yesterday. When you remember, you're no longer in your Volvo. You say, what am I doing? A bicyclist comes along and hits me. I could roll off the road here. And you stop. You're saying, what's this got to do with debt and equity and good projects and bad projects? Think of the Volvo as an all-equity funded company. Think of the cash cushions as airbags. Think of the red light as a bad project. Why do you run the red light? I protected you so much from your own mistakes, you stop caring. It's like driving a Hummer around a parking lot. You hit somebody, you don't even know you hit somebody. You wipe out that pure Toyota Celica there. You ran over it, the whole thing. You don't even realize it. You're protected. Think of the Yugo as the same company forced to borrow money. And think of the red light and think of why you stopped. You were afraid of getting hurt. This is called the Jensen free cash flow argument for debt. Remember the name Jensen? Did we use it somewhere else? This guy likes to attach his name to whatever he does. So Jensen's Alpha, Jensen free cash flow argument. He came up with this argument to explain why you had leverage buyouts at companies. And I think he went a little too far, because a leverage buyout, you don't just borrow money, you borrow way too much money, right? At the risk of stretching my analogy one step too far, it's like taking a Yugo into the car dealer. And even Yugos come with little air balloons. They're not quite big enough to be airbags. A little balloon comes out if you have an accident. And take it to the dealer and say, can you take this air balloon out and put in an air knife? You know what an air knife is? You hit something, a knife comes right out of the steering wheel. Do you think you'd ever drive this car? It'll sit in the driveway. I can walk to the station. 15 miles, I can run. That's what happens when you borrow too much money. Every mistake you make could be fatal to you, and you stop making decisions. So somewhere between the Volvo and the air knife, there's a happy compromise. You're trying to find that compromise. That's what the added discipline of debt is. Let's see if you get this. I'm going to give you three groups of companies, and I'd like you to tell me in which of these three groups of companies you'd expect to see debt act as a mechanism to discipline managers. Here's the first one. These are all companies with very little debt. The first company is a privately owned business. You are the owner and the manager. Do you need debt to make you more disciplined in your project choice? Why not? It's your own money. If you need debt to make you disciplined, you got some serious problems, psychological problems, self-destructive streak gone crazy. If it's a private business, you shouldn't borrow money to make yourself more disciplined. But let's take the other two. The second group is publicly traded companies with stock held by thousands, millions of investors, all of whom own 100 shares, 1,000 shares. And the third group is publicly traded companies where there is an activist or activists in the stockholder base. So which of those two groups would benefit more from borrowing money to keep their managers more disciplined? The dispersed investor base or the activist investor company? Why the dispersed? Somebody said dispersed. Because we have no power. If you have 1,000 shares, imagine calling the company and saying, hey, you guys are taking some really bad projects. Stop now. You have 1,000 shares. They're going to hang up the phone on you. You have little power. Managers do what they want. So I would expect debt to be a mechanism to discipline managers at an AT&T or a Disney, not at a Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg is enough at stake that he is not going to do something stupid because it's somebody else's money. So that's the second big benefit of debt, is that added discipline. Now let's talk about the costs of debt. We're all kind of familiar with the cost because anybody who's ever borrowed money knows there are consequences. Here's the first cost you have to worry about when you borrow money. When you borrow money, your expected bankruptcy cost goes up. You're saying, what the heck are you talking about? There are two components to an expected bankruptcy cost. The first is the probability that you'll have trouble making your debt payments drives the expected bankruptcy cost. So the greater that probability, the more likely you are to worry about going bankrupt. Seeing, wouldn't that be the same for every company? Let's have two companies, one with stable and predictable earnings. It's in a nice, safe business. The other is in a really good business, but there's a lot of volatility. I would expect the second company to have a higher probability of default for any given level of debt than the first company. So think technology versus utility. You can already see why the second company is going to borrow less than the first. So that's the probability of bankruptcy. That probability, though, has to be multiplied by the cost of bankruptcy. I'm going to ask you a question. This is going to sound like a really weird question, but humor me anyway. What's the cost of going bankrupt? Roy? Well, you're a company. So you're basically a legal entity. You stop existing. So you don't care about, as an individual, you're right. You worry about credit reputation. But if you're a company, you just fold up. The company name goes away. You're right. As that company, it'll be more difficult to borrow. Your shares will get wiped out. But remember, by the time a company declares bankruptcy, that process is already kind of unraveled to the point where your equity is worth close to nothing. What happens when you go bankrupt? What's the process of bankruptcy? Yeah. But in terms of the actual sequence, you declare bankruptcy. The day after you declare bankruptcy, who ends up running the company? Not quite. It ends up in the court system first. Incredibly efficient system, right? I became a U.S. citizen in the mid-90s. And about 6 months after I became a U.S. citizen, I got a letter in the mail informing me of one of my duties as a citizen had come up, which was jury duty. And to show you how naive I was really excited about it. So I circled that date in my calendar. I can't miss it. I told my wife, make sure you remind me. And on that day, I put on my best clothes. I even put on a tie, which I almost never do. I show up expecting, you know, balloons and celebration. First jury duty day, I walk in. There's this incredibly bored-looking woman sitting behind a desk. She says, what are you here for? I said, I'm here for jury duty. So go sit in that chair. Said, what do you do? Look at the monitor. So what am I looking for? Your number. What's my number? She says, are you blind? Look at your, there's a number there. I said, okay. What happens if my number doesn't come up? So come back again tomorrow. I said, how many days do I have to keep doing this until your number comes up? I said, I can't keep coming back every day. She said, don't worry, we pay $8 a day. I said, that settles it. $8 a day for the rest of my life. This is exactly my life plan, to come sit in a room, watch a monitor for a number that never comes. This is like a Twilight Zone episode. But it kind of gives you a window into how the legal system views the value of your time and my time, which is, it's worth nothing. In fact, there are only a few people in that entire building whose time is valued. And they're the lawyers. Everybody else, time value of money. If I created a law school, it'll be 2.5 years of time value of money is all I teach them. The last 3 months, a few law things, you know, you learn all that stuff. But time value of money, understand. You make a person wait 5 years, you might as well not pay him. And to show you how much of a drag this is on bankruptcies, in the 1970s, pretty much every U.S. railroad declared bankruptcy. That's how Amtrak was created. All these bankrupt railroads were rolled together. So this study actually looked at those bankruptcies to see, first, how long it took between the time a railroad declared bankruptcy and people got paid. Remember all those creditors who have to get paid? You know what it found? 7 years. Very biblical. You have to wait 7 years to get paid. And by the time you got paid, the assets that were used to pay you were half what they were at the time you declared bankruptcy. When did Lehman go bankrupt? 2008. My son is working on the Lehman bankruptcy. He actually works at an appraisal firm. The Lehman bankruptcy, they still haven't tied up the loose ends. $2 billion of legal costs later. $2 billion. That's what the Lehman bankruptcy cost is so far. $2 billion. Why would they tie up the loose ends? They want to keep the loose ends there because as long as the loose ends are there, you're going to charge by the hour. This could stretch on for eternity. That's called the dead weight cost of bankruptcy, the direct cost of bankruptcy. But if that were the only cost, I'd actually encourage companies to borrow more because you actually have to go bankrupt for those costs to unfold. You know the costs that really scare me? What I call the indirect cost of bankruptcy. Let me explain what the indirect cost of bankruptcy is. If, let's say you're a company. Let's say people start to think you're in trouble. Rumors start to spread that you might be in trouble. If people think you're in trouble, are you in trouble? This sounds like one of those riddles you have about a tree falling in the forest and nobody hears it fall. Explain why. If people think you're in trouble, let's say the people are your customers, potential customers. Why might the perception that you might be in trouble affect them? What's going to start happening? So if you sell cars, they're saying, I'm not buying your car. Your spare parts might not be around. I remember when Chrysler got into trouble in the early 1980s, people would come into Chrysler showrooms, look at a Chrysler car and say, I like that car, but I'm not buying it because I'm not sure you guys will be around. So your customers might stop buying your product. What do your suppliers start doing if they think you're in trouble? They come in and supply stuff. Usually they give you 90 days to pay. But because they know you're in trouble, they say, well, I'd like to see some cash, please. You try to give them a check. They say, no, no, that might bounce. Just stack up the currency and give it in to me. Your working capital needs go up. Your employees start checking out monster.com while they're sitting at their desk saying, I don't know whether I'll have a job in 2 weeks. The perception that you're in trouble actually puts you into trouble. That's the indirect cost of bankruptcy. So here are the two implications that come from this. The more volatile you're earning, the more uncertain you're about future earnings, the greater the probability of bankruptcy, and therefore the less you should borrow. The greater your expected bankruptcy cost because of the direct and the indirect costs, the less you should borrow. So let's try this out. I'm going to show you three companies. Assume they have the same operating income right now, the same cash flows today. And I want you to tell me which of these three companies you'd expect to borrow the least and which ones you'd expect to borrow the most. So here are the three companies. The first is a grocery store. The second is an airplane manufacturer. The third is a high-tech company. Let's start with the easy one. Which of these three companies should borrow the least? I'm sorry? And what about the high-tech company would lead them to borrow less? They have the same earnings today, but what's different? With a technology company, you don't know whether those earnings are going to be around next year in 2 years. You might sell a lot of smartphones today, like BlackBerry did in 2009. And by 2012, people say, I'm not buying a BlackBerry. It's old technology. So because your earnings are more uncertain, I'd expect the technology firm to borrow the least. Now let's move up the ladder. Let's look at grocery stores versus airplane manufacturers. Which of those two should borrow less? Think of indirect bankruptcy costs. Let's take Boeing, right? Let's suppose you learn tomorrow that Boeing becomes a double B rated company. That's bad, right? It's dropped below investment grade. You think, so what? You know what a typical contract for Boeing looks like? Singapore Airlines agrees to buy 15 Dreamliners over the next 20 years. There is no way Singapore Airlines is signing that contract with you if you're a double B rated company. About two or three weeks ago, I was in Victoria, British Columbia. If I'd known how much of a pain it was to get there, I would never have gone. You have to go to Vancouver. It's an island. It's like going through a different continent. I could have gone to China by then. So I landed in Victoria, and I did a valuation session. The company I looked at was Bombardier. You familiar with Bombardier? Even if you're not, the next time you're one of those little jets flying from, you know, short hauls, it's either going to be an Embraer or a Bombardier. Embraer is a Brazilian aerospace company. Bombardier is a Canadian aerospace company. What makes Bombardier different is they're a single B-rated company now. They're on the verge of default. And they're having huge trouble getting people to sign on and say, we'll buy Bombardiers for the next 10 years. Why? Because who wants to sign a 10-year contract with a single B-rated company? That's an indirect bankruptcy cost. What does that mean? If you're an airplane manufacturer, stay away from the ledge. Don't borrow money and tempt fate, because if something bad happens, you could very quickly become a Bombardier. Now let's look at a grocery manufacturer. I don't know about you. Now, walk into a grocery, I don't stop at the front and ask, is this a AAA-rated grocery store or a triple? Frankly, I don't care. It's not like I plan to bring the lettuce back in 2 years. There are no spare parts to lettuce as far as I know. So the grocery store, I'm perfectly okay as a customer with a triple B-rated grocery store. In other words, I could see a grocery store with a single B rating surviving, but I can't see Bombardier surviving with a single B rating. What does that mean? A grocery store can afford to borrow a lot more money, push its ratings down, and survive. An airplane manufacturer cannot. Some of the most successful leveraged buyouts in the 1980s were done on grocery stores. So the next time you see a news story about an LBO, a leveraged buyout, look at the target. Ask yourself, is this the kind of company where I can push the rating down to single B and not be affected? And the answer is no. It is a bad LBO. I don't care if it's KKR and Goldman Sachs rolled up in one doing the LBO. It is still a bad deal. If you get a chance, you go to my website. I actually have taken LBOs apart, and the target company I looked at was Harman Audio, the Tata Motors target. And I picked it because it was actually targeted by KKR and Goldman Sachs in an LBO. And at the time of the LBO, I took Harman Audio apart and said, this is the exact wrong company to target in an LBO because it's in a risky business with uncertain earnings. I don't see how this meets the qualifications. And I wasn't even looking at the numbers. I was just looking at the type of company it was, and it was not the kind of company you'd expect to be able to borrow money and get away without consequences. So that's expected bankruptcy costs. Any questions on that? Yes?
So the magnitude of bankruptcy is highest for grocery
stores? It's least. It's least. The expected bankruptcy cost, the property bankruptcy times the cost of bankruptcy, but because the cost is lower for a grocery store, they can afford to borrow more money, so the costs are lower. Justin? Why? But the revenues are fixed as well. It's not like, see, for your cost to really affect your income has to collapse. And that can happen only if people stop going into the grocery store. So if you, for instance, and that's why I said that's the indirect bankruptcy cost. If you read in the newspaper that Gristedes is in trouble, does that stop you from going in? If that's your regular grocery store, and the answer is no, you're much more. It's not that you're not affected. You're affected less than a company where customers' purchase decisions are affected by whether you're in trouble. As a rule, the more durable a product is, the more you have to worry about indirect bankruptcy costs, right? Because you have to worry about servicing and parts and all the rest. So those are the businesses where the indirect bankruptcy costs are going to be highest. Any other questions on bankruptcy costs? Roy?
So the indirect are the highest for...
Airplane manufacturer. Right.
But would you say the total magnitude, including the direct cost, would be highest for technology?
It's not the magnitude, it's the probability. See, there are two components. So it's, I think in technology companies actually have lower bankruptcy costs than an airplane manufacturer, but a much higher probability because their revenues are so unpredictable. Now let's talk about agency costs. You know what an agency cost is? The cost of somebody acting on your behalf, that's half the story. What's the problem with having somebody else act on your behalf? They don't seem to care as much about you as you do. You notice this? Nobody in the world cares as much about you as you do. It's a reality. So let's make this real. Let's assume it's 3 weeks from now, you have a group meeting for your corporate finance project. Remember that project that's been on the back burner for so long you forgot the project? So it's late at night. You're sitting around. It's 8 o'clock. You're all famished. So one of the people in the group is actually doing nothing. He has no idea what's going on. Offers to go for sandwiches for everybody. He said, finally, this guy's doing something. So he goes around and he gets all your orders. He comes to you and says, what do you want? And you're very specific. He says, I want turkey on wheat, no mayo, lots of mustard. He's not even listening. He goes off. He gets the sandwich. Around. What did you want again? I don't know, ham on white, lots of mayo, no mustard. You might be allergic to ham for all you care, or somebody who can't eat ham. He doesn't care. It's not his sandwich. That's an agency cost. But I'll give you something that I can relate to much better. None of you have kids, right, that you know of? Okay, so good. Hey, but at some point in time in the future, you might have kids. My wife and I, when our kids were small, used to go out 3 times a year. And shortly, you'll see why only 3 times a year. So this was, to go out, of course, when your kids are small, you have to have a babysitter. And this is like a 6-week planning period you've got to set up. You've got to have a babysitter, back up to the babysitter, back up to the back up to the babysitter. So the big day arrives. 7 o'clock, the babysitter's not there. 7:22, she wanders in. You're just glad she's here. You hand your third and fourth and fifth most prized possessions in the world to her and say, we're leaving for the restaurant. They're all fed, they're all set, they're bathed, they're all ready to go at 9 o'clock. They have to go to bed. And after 9 o'clock, make sure they eat nothing, especially nothing sugary. The babysitter nods, oh, yeah, of course, of course. And you go off to the restaurant. 9 o'clock rolls around. The babysitter's ensconced in front of the TV, and she's just turned on Pretty Little Liars. Don't ask me. I watched this with my daughter for 5 weeks. I thought I was going to go crazy. I said, what is this? For 5 years, they couldn't find a murderer. They keep talking about the murder all the time. How bad does a detective have to be to not solve this? She turns on Pretty Little Liars. Kids can sense weakness like nobody's business. They detect that the babysitter is vulnerable. So they come down the stairs. It's like an army coming down. It's kind of scary when you see kids do this. They come down and they go to the babysitter and say, we want ice cream, we want candy. The implicit threat is, if you don't give this to us, no Pretty Little Liars. You can see the babysitter's calculus work out, right? You can either stick with the line, say, no candy, no ice cream, in which case you don't watch the show. Or you say, go to the freezer, take all the ice cream you want, take the sugar bowl, take it up with you. In fact, take the whole bag of sugar up with you. Just don't come down till 10 o'clock. So guess what? She says, take all the sugar. They go upstairs. They're eating sugar like it's going out of style. She watches the show. 10 o'clock rolls around. You come back home. Everything okay? Yes, yes, yes. The babysitter takes off like a bullet out of the door. So why did she leave so fast? She's in her car, gone down the street before you even know it. You go upstairs, and the kids are not sleeping. They're bouncing off the walls, the ceilings. So what happened here? And you see the open cartons of ice cream and sugar bowls all over the place, and you know exactly what happened. So you know what's going to happen next, right? No sleep that night, and next morning. This is why you go out only 3 times a year. There are 2 ways you can deal with agency problems. The first is you can build the cost into your decisions, which is what we did, which is if you go out, you're not going to sleep that night. Therefore, we don't go out. That's the first way. The second solution, and this is a potential solution, is what's called the monitoring solution. You know what that is? You put cameras all over your house to watch what's going on while you're gone. So at the restaurant, you're watching your kids on a monitor. They're coming down. The freezer is opening. She's taking the ice cream out. At this point, you need some kind of zapping mechanism to get either the babysitter or the kids. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So maybe you have laser bullets and something that puts them out. But that could probably get you into trouble with DIFUS or somebody. So I don't think that's feasible. The monitoring solution or build it into cost solution. Roy? That's it. That's a cost solution, right? You build it in. Now, let's see how this plays out with debt and equity. You guys want to be the bank? No, you are going to be the bank. It's not a choice. You'll be the bank. You guys be equity investors. Let's go borrow money from the bank. You ready? Let's walk over. We want to borrow money for a project. How should we describe this project? Safe or risky?
Safe.
Very safe. It's almost guaranteed. Let's say you're a trusting banker. I've described this as an oxymoron. You're either a banker, you're trusting, you can't be both. But let's say you say, oh, you look honest, here's $1 billion. So they lend us $1 billion. No strings attached. We did tell them we were going to take safe project, but that's words. It's not on paper anywhere. So now that we have $1 billion, do you think our incentives might be different? Rather than take a safe project, could I take a risky? Forget about risky projects. What if we just go to the racetracks or Atlantic City and put $1 billion on number 23? Number 21 comes up. What happens? We've lost $1 billion. Walk to the bank and say, guys, we lost it all. We're a corporation, though. We have limited liability. You can come in and take all our assets. But guess what? We have no assets. But if it, number 23 actually had come up, what would have happened? 1 million would have become, or one billion would have become 15 billion. We pay the banker back. We get to keep the remaining 13.8 billion. This is an asymmetric game where we get the upside, they get the downside. And guess what? We are going to take riskier projects than we described to the bank. We might pay ourselves a dividend. We might buy back stock. We're not going to do all the things we told the banker we were going to do. This is why you're not a trusting banker. So when I come in and say, we're going to take safe projects, what do you think? It's a risky project. Like this voice in the back say, no, no, we'll replace safe with risky. So rather than lend to us at 3%, you lend at 25%. You bring it into the cost by charging me a higher interest rate, assuming I will do stupid things with your money. I also write in covenants. You know what covenants are? They're constraints on what I can and cannot do. They restrict me on what I cannot. They tie my hands. The way I describe debt is like being put into a straitjacket. And more money you borrow, the tighter the straitjacket becomes. That's an agency cost you've got to factor in. The more you value being free, being able to make decisions quickly, the less you should borrow. So let's look at three companies, and you tell me which of these three companies will be most concerned about being in a straitjacket. The first is a technology company. The second is a large regulated utility. And the third is a real estate corporation. Let's start with the first two. Which of the first two worries more about being constrained? Anybody? And why? They're already constrained, right? If you're a regulated utility, there are lots of things you cannot do. You're saying, what's this real estate company doing in there? There's one thing, though, that seems to affect this agency problem. When lenders lend money on physical assets, they seem to feel more secure than they lend it against something intangible. It's almost psychological. So if I build a big casino in Atlantic City, I cover it with gold and I put my name on it. I won't name any names. Bankers line up. You want a billion, you want 2 billion, you want 3 billion, you want 5 billion. Name your price. We just want to lend you money. It looks big and it looks golden. But I could be the greatest pharmaceutical company in the world with a patent that produces huge cash flows, but a bank will not lend me money because it's not physical and they can't see it. I think real estate borrows way too much money. If you ask me collectively as a business, it makes no sense, but bankers seem to feel more secure about lending to it. That's the thing. That's what I don't get. First, if you're a bank and you're selling the asset to get your money back, you've already lost the game, right? Why have you lost the game? Because you're going to bear all kinds of costs. For a bank, that is a bad portfolio. Portfolio where you're selling their... When you lend money, you lend based on cash flows. You shouldn't be lending based on the asset's value. And here's why it's an illusory benefit. You're lending against real estate, right? How is the real estate appraised? Based on what real estate values are right now. So let's say it's the middle of a boom. Right now in Manhattan, you're in the middle of a boom. The appraiser says that building is worth $25 million. Let's say you decide to lend $22 million against the $25 because it's worth $25. When is this guy not going to pay you back? Not when this real estate is continuing to boom. It's because real estate has fallen, right? You've lent $22 million against a $25 million property. So I don't have a problem with you lending against real estate, but I don't see why you should lend 80%. That's what I don't get, given the fact that real estate values can change so much. But somehow, the physicality of real estate seems to lead people to lend a lot more than they should. So I understand the motivation, but I don't understand how this can be a good business if you continue to lend against physical assets just because they look like they have value today. So let's close with that. When we come back, when we start on Wednesday, we will continue this discussion and start to put some numbers on this trade-off.
Yeah. And they're essentially clean buildings that mm-hmm. activity. You depreciate a service.
You can't depreciate a cleaning lady. Cannot.
So on our case,
yeah,
we didn't. I wrote off the capex. I think.
No, that's maintenance. You're thinking about. That's not capex. Capex,
oh,
capital,
right.
Maintenance.
I didn't call it capital maintenance.
Capital maintenance is replacing all the sinks in all of the bathrooms. It's not the people.
If I said the ordinary repairs,
that's not going to be enough, right? Capital maintenance is that physical assets have wear and tear, and you need to replace them if you want the building looking new. I mean, look at how much money we put into that front end, the lobby, the remodeling. That was a capital maintenance. That cost us almost $7 million. Right, so that will show up as capital maintenance and get depreciated.
But if we had like $1 billion studio in India, and then just year after year, it's getting potholes being rebuilt, the roof's getting redone, that type of stuff. But nothing. We're never replacing the building.
Then for a 10-year life, I don't have a problem with that.
But then for the
perpetual life, exactly. You have equipment to replace for the studio. Here's what it's going to be: your camera equipment will get technological. So in a sense, 10 years, you might say, look, I have enough equipment, I can get it through. But if you're talking about a longer life, you have to, in a sense, set aside money to cover that capital maintenance, replacing those big equipment.
If I don't depreciate my capital maintenance on a 10-year life, that should be okay?
If you put zero depreciation, so you're not counting any tax benefits?
No, we have depreciation, but we're not depreciating and allocating for that capital maintenance. And then, let's assume in the sentence above, I said, we assume this costs ordinary repairs, and it's not depreciated.
But what's happened to your physical assets? Ordinary repairs can't fix it. So are you setting aside $80 million in ordinary repairs?
Yes.
You're setting aside that $80 million in ordinary repairs?
For $1 billion studio, possibly.
What's the number you set aside in yours? $80 million, the reason I said $80 million, that's a depreciation amount.
I did set it aside.
So you said $80 million, showed it as an expense?
I could say it's conservative, but yeah.
Is this a
hypothetical? I actually wrote down, I'm writing off $80 million as capital maintenance. We assume this only as.
But where is it showing up? So your income each year, you're showing
paid,
it as.
It's paid as cash.
As an expense. So you're showing it as an expense.
Yeah.
So your income each year is lower by $80 million.
Yes.
Okay, bring it in. I'll take a look at it.
Okay. Okay. Cool.
Do you do it in both cases or just in the longer life?
We did it for one of our assumptions.
But for both the finite and the perpetual life, or just the perpetual life? Do you see what I'm asking? Because if you did it for both, you still have a problem, right? Because then you're doing too much in the finite life case. You're putting in an expenditure for a project that actually is going to get run down.
Given that it was an assumption, isn't it? This is kind of
no, the assumption has to vary across the two scenarios. It can't be the same assumption for two.
I'll bring it in.
Okay.
Because I